ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Eric Phillips has always loved the cold, which is lucky because he has spent a lot of time in some of the coldest places on the planet. Eric is a polar adventurer, and he's visited both the South and the North Poles dozens of times. And so he's experienced what those environmental extremes can do to the human body and also to human relationships. In March this year, Eric got the opportunity to see the polar regions from a completely new perspective when he flew into space on board a SpaceX Crew Dragon capsule and spent 4 days in orbit before splashing down in the Pacific Ocean. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Sarah.
Are you used to people being able to say that about you yet? That bit about, you know, being in space and orbiting the polar regions?
Not really, because I have to pinch myself that I've been up there too, you know. It's like that's reality trying to settle in with me.
Did you inherit this sense of adventure from your parents? Is it something you share with your mum and dad?
I think I did because, you know, I was really inspired by the stories, first of all, that my dad told me about cycling through Europe, you know, shortly after the Second World War. And then, of course, my parents, they emigrated from Holland, from the Netherlands. And, you know, that takes a little bit of exploration-mindedness and adventure-mindedness.
What brought them out to Australia?
I think they needed the space, both the headroom and the geographical space. You know, the Netherlands is a pretty tight-knit country. The neighbours are very closely packed in, and I just think they saw the open, swept beauties of Australia as being very appealing.
Your parents ended up having 6 children, which is an adventure in and of itself. What about time exploring, camping, that sort of stuff? Was that a big part of your childhood?
Huge. Yeah, my parents were lovers of the outdoors. We did little day hikes in the Adelaide Hills. We went on weekenders and even 2 weeks to the Flinders Ranges, across into Victoria, the Gammons. And how did they take 6 young children on those camping trips? I still have no idea because I have 2 children of my own and that was tough enough.
But 2 weeks in Flinders Ranges is one thing. How did the idea of polar exploration first capture your imagination?
Really, the thing that gelled in me was pulling a National Geographic magazine out of a bookshelf at home and poring through the pages and it's stopping at one photograph in particular, which is a guy dressed up like the Michelin Man standing on this white disc with this dome of blue above him. And that was an Antarctic expeditioner. And at that moment, I thought to myself, I want to be that guy. And kind of the rest of my life really was directed towards me inserting myself in that photograph.
What was it, do you think, that was so appealing to you?
The remoteness, the otherworldliness, the way that he was dressed. These were things that we just weren't familiar with. And yet here they were on our planet. So they must be accessible. They must be places I could get to.
And what about the prospect of testing yourself? Was that something that when you look back, you see was already part of your character as a kid?
Without a doubt. Yeah, I was a really physical kid. You know, I would be in the gully out the back of our house, roaming through the bushes and clambering up little rock cliffs. And it was a way for me to expend energy, but also to engage with the world in the only way that I knew how.
So how did this icy dream of yours, how did it become a reality? What was the first polar adventure that you planned?
That was in 1992 and it was the final year as head of outdoors at Timbertop.
This is the Geelong boarding school.
Geelong Grammar School's sort of outdoor campus, if you like, where the kids board for a year. And I was there for 5 years. And during the last couple of years, I just had this hankering to go south or north. Any of them would do, so long as I was beyond the Arctic or Antarctic circle. And so I put together a committee of students and a couple of like-minded staff and started planning this trip to Ellesmere. And so we got some funding to go way up north in the north of Ellesmere Island and complete my first polar expedition, a ski expedition.
And that's part technically of Canada, is it, that island? What's
Correct.
The terrain look like?
Typically polar. It's mountainous. There are frozen fjords. Not so much when we were there because we were there in the height of summer. We could expect, well, cold temperatures, but not the extreme cold that I would later would later define me as a polar explorer.
So this was your first taste of that kind of landscape that had been in your mind for so long. Did it live up to your expectations?
Completely. And utterly, you know, I came back from that and I was convinced that this is what I needed to do. I was kind of done with teaching. I love my time at Timbertop, but for me it was time to move on.
You ended up meeting the woman who'd become your wife around this time. How did that happen, Eric?
So I was living in Melbourne at the time, starting to plan my next expedition, which was a crossing of Greenland. And at that time, I put an ad in the paper looking for someone to be a flatmate. And Susie replied to the ad and the rest is history.
So I think Susie was pregnant with your first child when you set off for Greenland. You used kites on that expedition. Had that been done before, the use of kites?
Certainly the use of wind had been something in previous polar expeditions. Even Scott, back in the early 1900s, toyed with the idea of having a mast and a rudimentary sail on his sledge. But the use of traction kites, which are essentially what we see on the water very typically these days, they're a ram air kite and the cells in the kite inflate with air and then drag you across the water or the snow. But pretty early days of those, and I was at Elwood at my flat, sort of about to head off on my rollerblades to hit the foreshore and cruise down to Westgate Bridge and back, as I often did. And there were a bunch of guys kiting on buggies at this on this oval. And I went over there and introduced myself and said, I need some of these to take me across Greenland. Can you teach me how to use them? And they looked at me quizzically and said, yeah, have a go. And within seconds, I was on my stomach being dragged across the grass. But I was convinced that that was our solution to cover long distances in shorter periods of time.
So how does it actually work? How did it work in Greenland, these kites?
Well, typically you need a wind that is behind you. These days, you know, people are so adept and their skis are so finely tuned and their kites are so finely tuned that you can actually use a side wind to gain forward progress. But back in those days, we could literally use them just to run downwind. So when we had a wind mostly behind us, we could launch these kites, and the kites were attached to a harness that we wore, and the harness was the central point between the pulling of the kite and the pulling of the sled behind us. And we were kind of this floating unit in between, I guess. So we didn't really have to use our arms too much. It wasn't a super physical thing. But we did have to steer them. We had to avoid crevasses. We had to somehow keep ourselves warm in these very, very cold temperatures. And the wind chill, of course, because we're generating this wind on us as we're kiting. So there was a lot to deal with, but on that day, and I remember it quite well, you know, pulling out the GPS and having a look at our distance and covering 80 kilometres in a single day, that was mind-blowing and almost unprecedented.
Sort of sounds like it would be incredibly fun too.
Absolutely.
On the kite.
Yeah, we called them our nylon huskies. And they were just these gorgeous, colourful kites in front of us, and we would loop them and figure-eight them to generate power. And towards the other side of Greenland, when we were amongst the crevasse fields, we started to be able to steer with them a bit better and power on. For example, if we were heading towards a crevasse, initially we would stop and we'd put the kite away and we'd find a safe way across the crevasse and then launch the kites again. But eventually we would just power on shortly before hitting the crevasse, launch over the top of them, feel our sleds clunk, clunk over these ravines, and then continue on the other side.
How would you've been confident that the distance in that crevasse wasn't too big?
We were overconfident, really, you know, and unfortunately, you know, I've had friends who have died as a result of doing exactly this, getting caught in crevasses, being unable to extract themselves.
Those early expeditions, Eric, to Ellesmere Island and to Greenland were all leading up to this dream to get to Antarctica. Why was Antarctica? Why did it have such a place in your mind? What was it, the goal?
You know, it obviously harks back to that photograph as a 12-year-old boy looking at that guy, and I wanted to be that person. But it was also far-flung. It was a long way from anywhere. And it was also a long way from humans. Not that I dislike my fellow humans. I love you all. But the further I got from people, the more isolated, remote and exploratory it felt.
There's also an extraordinary history of exploration in that part of the world. Is the romance of that part of it for you, or was it part of it for you as well?
Yeah, completely. You know, I loved reading books about early polar exploration.
They often end badly.
Yes, they typically ended badly back in that era. And, you know, we call this the heroic era because, you know, they were unearthing things that had never been seen before. They were doing things that were unprecedented. They were putting themselves on the line. And, you know, we were the second iteration of that that went with more of an adventurer ethic.
How did you first get your foot through the door in Antarctica? Because you started off working there before you were exploring there.
Yeah, I did. After three applications or so with the Australian Antarctic Division, they finally accepted me.
You wore them down.
I wore them down, but also I'd completed that Greenland crossing successfully, and I think this really was my ticket. And it demonstrated that I was serious about the polar environments, that I was a capable polar adventurer or explorer by then, that I cared about the welfare of my fellow team members, and with my background in teaching too, that the instructing and guiding aspect of that role as a field training officer was something that I could do.
Did it also leave you time to explore while you were working at Mawson Station?
Yeah, it did. I mean, typically we weren't allowed to leave the station by ourselves, but there were a lot of lovely areas very near the station that I would go out on the weekend. If I wasn't able to find a participant that would go out with me on what we call the jolly, it wasn't work-related, but we could take four-wheel quad motorbikes out across the ice and climb mountains. But now and again, I'd venture by myself, sometimes with a kite too, into the little hills nearby and have these lovely, isolated, solo adventures.
After that summer season of working in Antarctica, tell me about the expedition to the South Pole that you were planning. How was it going to run?
Yeah, even looking back at my time at Mawson Station, every time I went up onto the plateau above the station, I would look south. South to an area that you just couldn't see, obviously, because it's thousands of kilometres from there to the South Pole. But it was that tiny little point at 90 degrees south that I wanted to reach in one way or another. So when I returned home from that four-month stint or so, I talked to Susie about these upcoming plans. It's like, hang on, you've been home, what, minutes?
And you're talking about laundry before you even suggest this, Eric.
Completely, you know, and I think about it now, it's like, God, how brash. How is it that she put up with me after all these years? But I did start planning this South Pole expedition and very quickly invited John Muir, who I'd met in the back of an outdoor store in Melbourne, and we clicked immediately.
He's a famous explorer.
Yeah. Exactly, and not just polar stuff, but, you know, he climbed Everest back in 1988 and then went on to do some incredible desert crossings and a south-north unassisted crossing of Australia too. So I invited John and we set about planning this expedition, but he wouldn't be the only other person to join me on that trip.
Why was it important to have a third person? I mean, I guess you're thinking about how the dynamics of a crew are going to work. What's the thinking behind who you take with you?
Yeah, that's right. I'd not done a trip with John before, but I wanted someone that had this long distance, long duration ethic and background and experience. And John exuded that. And then we talked about having a third person and we decided maybe this would be a good thing so that just three seemed to be a better mix because if it was just to the two of us and one, we had a falling out, that would be a very difficult thing to deal with.
So who did you invite to come along with you?
John actually suggested a guy that he'd done some mountain expeditions with, and that was Peter Hillary, who was the son of Sir Edmund Hillary. Peter had shown his mettle in the mountains. He'd climbed Everest, of course, and he'd done traverses of the Himalaya. And I immediately saw the benefit of having someone with that kind of skill, given that we were going to traverse glaciers, particularly the Shackleton Glacier, for the first time. And, you know, to have two mountaineers in my midst, it seemed to be a good decision.
So when the three of you set off, what sort of support did you have? I mean, were there dogs, were there other crew or what?
Us, our sleds, our skis, our kites. So we were delivered at the start point there at Ross Island. I mean, what an incredible place. This is the same island location that Robert Scott and his companions began from, that Shackleton began from back in the early 1900s. So here we were, you know, a hardy team of three adventurers on the edge of Antarctica ready to ski 1,425 kilometres south up a glacier never before traversed to the South Pole.
You must have had a plan of how far you had to travel each day. Were you able to meet that?
From the very early days, I could see that we just couldn't meet that objective. We had incredibly heavy sleds. They started at 200 kilograms and we could barely move them. You know, we needed four, five, six people just to carry them onto the scales and weigh them. It's like, crikey, how are we going to get these things across the ice? So immediately we took 10 kilograms of food from that, thinking, well, we'll just make up that time. So starting off with 190 kilograms was kind of crazy, but we had no choice. You know, if we were to complete the first out and back to the South Pole from an outer coastline of Antarctica on skis unsupported, you know, we kind of had to suck it up.
How regularly do you need to take breaks when you're traveling in those environments with that kind of huge weight?
You know, we would do up to 2 hours and then take a short break, you know, stuff as much food and fluid into our gobs as we could and then continue. And it could be argued that, well, maybe you just need to travel further in the day before you take a break, because every break impinges on your forward movement.
Is it hard to get going again also after you've... Yeah. What if you stop and you maybe get a bit warm and rest for a moment?
Yeah, it does, yeah. And particularly, you know, we had this thing called a bivy that we used that we would throw over us, not so much in the early days because it was damn warm down on the Ross Ice Shelf, sometimes uncomfortably so, and we'd just be in our thermals and baking in the heat. But up on the plateau, we would put this bivy bag over the top of us, this bothy bag, and protect ourselves from the wind. And immediately we would see the ice, but by then it had accreted to our face masks and directly onto our noses and chins. We would see it melting and dripping away, and we would feel the warmth seeping back to our bones. And we just didn't want to leave that thing, and it was our own worst enemy.
What were the dynamics between the team as the days went on, Eric?
Well, not even as the days went on. You know, in the first day or two, we could see that there were some serious challenges ahead of us within the team. We all struggled from the heavy loads at that time, and had we bitten off more than we could chew. But I recall looking at Peter in the tent on that very first night and just having reservations about his capacity to continue that distance and turn around at the South Pole and then return...
Do it all over again.
And I wrote in my diary on the second day that I had my doubts about whether we would arrive at the South Pole intact, and John wrote it in his diary on the very first day.
And do people like you think, when you find yourself writing something like that down on night one, maybe we should turn around?
Look, no, actually, that was never an option. And we had an agreement with Antarctica New Zealand, who had flown us in and supported us and provided logistics. We had an agreement that because we were a deep field expedition, if we were reduced to a team of two, we were all out. We had no choice but to proceed as a team of three. So irrespective of the fact that one of us was feeling the crunch on that first couple of days and continued to do so for the remainder of the journey, we just couldn't bail. It was all or nothing.
So how does a team of three men support one another in those sort of circumstances?
Yeah. Look, it was difficult, and, you know, I was a bulldog back in those days, and I kind of still am. You know, I just had this crazy drive, you know, to push through and to achieve something like this. And I was gifted with stamina, both mental, emotional and physical endurance. And I knew that I could weather the storm of being out there for months at a time. And I knew that I could do that. And I could see that John had the capacity to do that. And on paper, it seemed like Peter could too. But that first evening, you know, he missed his kids, and his kids were young at the time. I mean, I had a young child at the time too, my daughter Marty. But I, this bulldog mentality just overrode everything. And it's like, Peter, you got to pick it up here. We've just got stuff to do and get out of this tent and move.
How long did it end up taking this unhappy band of adventurers to make it to the South Pole?
Look, we still have the record for the slowest ever expedition to the South Pole. It took us 84 days. And I believe that even Scott took 70 days or so to arrive at the South Pole, and we were 2 weeks beyond that.
Was there a sense of achievement, though, when you actually made it to that 90 degrees south that you dreamt of for so long?
Oh, yeah, there were periods along the route that we really ticked off and said, this is a massive achievement. I mean, the first people to ski the full length of the Shackleton Glacier. But, yeah, for us, you know, the 84 days to the South Pole, it's not a great record, but at least we got there, you know, intact.
At least. I still think this is pretty impressive. But it meant that you didn't have the time to ski back as you'd planned. So how did you get home from the South Pole?
We were picked up by American Hercules, and we flew back, and they essentially flew over the very route that we'd taken to ski there. And, you know, we completed that flight back in, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours or so, the same journey that took us 84 days to achieve.
Has your perspective on that changed over the years, Eric? I mean, it sounds like it's still sticking in your claw a little bit now.
Yes, it is, but you know, I've certainly mellowed from my really hardcore take on it that we just were a crap team. We just never could mobilize, and that I just didn't accept that, you know, someone that missed their family as much as Peter did, and of course I did too, but I didn't accept that that was a valid reason for us not being able to cover the distance and reach our objective. Now, of course, I guide people on the ice all the time, and I've seen the way that various clients behave when they're confronted by massive distances, when they're confronted by the brutal environment that we're in. And yeah, I've certainly mellowed on my perspective.
What about your own family, your mum and dad, say? What did they think about these big journeys that you were taking, these big risks?
What the hell are you doing? You know, it's because I finished at Timbertop, and I remember standing in the kitchen at my parents' house in Adelaide and telling them that I was quitting this wonderful job and I was going to become a professional explorer. It's like, yeah, what? What the hell is that? How do you make a living from that? Come on, get to your, you know, bring back your senses. And but you know, I had this conviction that that's what I was going to do. And I set about that with that same bulldog mentality that I can achieve this.
They had lost your older brother, Kun, unexpectedly. Tell me about that. What was your brother like?
Yeah, Kun was, like all of my siblings, of course, you know, a really special member of our family. He was somewhat of an artist. He loved ceramics. He'd studied at Underdale University in Adelaide. And he made weird and wacky stuff that still adorns the walls and shelves of my house and my siblings and my dad. But he also was a sort of recreational drug user. And he came unstuck with a bad batch of heroin, you know, injected himself with something, was home alone, and that killed him. And it's incredible how raw it still is. You know, this is almost 30 years later, because myself and my brother, we had arranged to go to the movies, the three of us together. And Kun, he was my older brother. He didn't rock up. So it's like, oh, okay. So he probably went to a party, which was not an unusual thing for him to do on most weekends. And then he wasn't at the Sunday dinner arranged at my parents' house, and it's like, oh crikey, I've got a bad feeling about this. So Ralph and I, we jumped in my car and I went to his house and found him. Yeah.
I'm so sorry. That's a terrible thing to discover and a terrible loss in a family. You know, when you look back, do you think losing him that way, did it shape any of the choices you were making about your own life, or were you already on this path?
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. It's interesting because in our family, risk taking is embedded in our just in our psyche. Risk taking, kind of living life on the edge, and I lived life on the edge through my adventures, and Kun did it in a different way.
In 2002, Eric, you set off for an expedition to the North Pole. Are the conditions similar whether you're journeying to the South or the North Pole?
Look, the only thing that they've got in common is that they can be incredibly cold and that they're, you know, ice environments. But Antarctica is it's a continent. It's covered in ice, and it's up to 4 kilometres thick at its height in the centre of Antarctica. So it moves very slowly. This is a colossal ice cap, and it moves a few metres per year. But it's essentially a very stable environment, whereas the North Pole, the Arctic, it's an ocean. And that ocean and the ice that's in it is subject to the forces of wind and currents and waves, and it gets pushed around. So it can move metres, not only per day, but per hour, even per second.
And it's an ocean, so that means you can only travel there if you're crossing the ice in wintertime.
Yeah, winter and late spring. And, of course, icebreakers can plough through, and there will be a point in perhaps the not-too-distant future where sailing boats might even arrive at the North Pole, God forbid. But you do need to be there in winter and into spring. And we want to be there because that's when the ice is at its most stable, and we're there to ski.
Can you explain or put into words at all what that sort of cold feels like, minus 40?
Yeah, it's this sensation that starts from your fingertips because, of course, they're your extremities and the first things that I feel because I have terrible circulation in my extremities, which is kind of bizarre for a polar explorer, and you feel it on your nose and anywhere on your face that's exposed, even a square millimetre of skin that's exposed to this wind, particularly if it's coming as a headwind. And even though we wear these fur ruffs on the hoods of our jacket that create a microclimate around our faces and protect ourselves somewhat, you feel it acutely on your body. So it stems from your fingertips and then draws up from your toes. You feel it through your boots. And you get to the point even when you step off the pack ice and onto raw ice that has just recently refrozen, which was open water perhaps the day before, you feel that cold immediately through your boots. Even though you're wearing the best insulated boots in the world, you feel it immediately. In fact, even as you approach these areas of thin ice, you feel this pall of cold coming towards you.
Does the tent, when you're inside the tent, say at night, does that offer any protection? Is it any warmer inside the tent?
It should have been warmer inside the tent, but I, with this objective of selecting equipment that is minimalist and lightweight and as minimum bulk as possible, I selected a single skin tent without a floor. Without a floor. I mean, what does a nylon floor give you anyway? It's not going to give you any protection, from the cold. But the downside with a single skin tent is you don't generate an atmosphere of warmth inside. And now, of course, I know that we need that in order to recover in the evenings because we climb out of the bitter cold, we climb into the tent, we light the stove, and without that insulating second layer in the tent, you can't build up the warmth inside to recover and step out the next day and do it all over again.
On this trip, you were travelling again with John Muir. How did you see him start to struggle with the cold?
Yeah, John had a pretty bad time on that, but the reason for that was that he had just recently trekked across Australia from south to north. He hadn't regained his full weight. He hadn't regained his emotional and mental state, but he was committed to pulling this off. You know, this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, so he committed to it, but he suffered for it.
He fell through the ice at one point. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we reach one of these leads or these avenues of open water, and it's where the ice is separated, revealing the Arctic Ocean right there. And we had amphibious sleds that we could actually paddle from one side to the other. But we really only needed to do that in open water. And this lead had somewhat partially frozen. Now, we were kind of trying to make a decision, should we cross here, should we cross there? It probably took us 15 minutes. We started getting more heavily dressed, putting on our down jackets, and eventually I made the decision, I'm going to cross here. So I left the sleds on John's side and I went across by myself, and I took a very lightweight sort of piece of 2 millimeter cord that I attached to the sled so I could pull them across afterwards. I got to the other side. I called back to John and I said, John, seems good to go. Give it a crack. And I was watching him ski across the ice, and I could just see it like a trampoline slowly bounce lower and lower. And I called out, John, I think you should. And that was it. He crunched through the ice and he went up to his neck. His boots filled with water. His down jacket was completely flooded. And we were in one hell of a predicament, a long way from anywhere.
Could you get him out, first of all? Like, how did he clamber out of that?
Well, there was still ice between him and me, so he couldn't just clamber out on the ice and walk towards me because it would just simply break as he did so. So, you know, there was mild panic, I guess, that set in. But because I had this tiny thin line attached to the sleds on the other side that John had started from, I flicked that across to him and he wound a couple of wraps around his wrist, his hand, and I started pulling and he started heaving and kind of doing this butterfly stroke through the ice to break through the ice and get to me. And once he arrived at the bank, we'd noticed that one ski had fallen from his foot and had by then spiralling to the bottom of the ocean.
Well, I guess first of all, he had to get dry and warm. What did that involve?
Yeah, so we need to get out of here. We didn't know whether this would continue to be a fragile and desperate place, so we needed to move away from there. So we did that, got to the other side of a pressure ridge, pitched the tent, got John inside, I got the stove going, and we just spent the next 6 hours trying to recover John. He was in a bad state, very close to hypothermia. I got, you know, bottles of hot water and threw those in the sleeping bag. We had to get all of the wet clothing off him. Otherwise, his sleeping bag would get dangerously wet, wouldn't provide insulation for him. So it was a critical time, but one that we managed to get through.
And what about the lost ski?
Yeah, we carried a spare ski, thankfully, and then could manage to continue forward.
How many days did it take you to make it to the North Pole?
58 days, that one. And we started from the edge of Russia, not quite the edge because there was so much water just to the north of that island, Severnaya Zemlya, an archipelago off the north coast of Russia, with about 920 kilometres between our start point and the North Pole. So 58 days of hell. But it was the kind of hell that we expected and we got.
And
chose ourselves. and really, you're not a true polar explorer unless you've experienced the brutality of a North Pole expedition, in my view.
How do you even know when you've reached the North Pole, given it's this shifting space? It's not a continental landmass the way Antarctica is.
Yeah. At the South Pole, it's really easy. And you see it coming up for a couple of days beforehand. You see the, you know, the water vapour that's being emitted by this research station that is right there at the South Pole at 90 degrees south. There's no such thing there at the North Pole. There can't be, because that surface of ice is moving all the time. So whatever you place at the North Pole on top of that floating platform of ice moves within seconds. So we need to rely on our GPS to give us a position, and we can walk around and literally find 90 degrees on that GPS. You can't input into a GPS 90 degrees as a waypoint. You can only find that by standing there. So anyone that has been to the North Pole, they pretty much have a GPS with 90 degrees locked into it.
What was that moment like when you realised you were there?
A massive relief. And that's the sentiment from everybody that skis to the North Pole, that thank goodness it's over.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, we don't need to be slogging across this ice and towing these heavy weights and waking up another morning. It was utter relief.
How do you get back home?
Yeah, we had what was called an Argos beacon, which was an early tracking device, and we switched that onto the one single setting that said, arrived at the North Pole, come and get us.
What sort of physical state were you in after that trip?
In pretty bad shape. There was I had frostbite on my finger, a number of fingertips. They had blackened by then. Thankfully, the frostbite was isolated to above my last joint, so I didn't lose the fingertips. John was decimated physically. He was in pretty bad shape. Look, we both were, and there was no way that we could have pulled off another day after that.
What do you eat after going through something like that? What does your body need?
Yeah, there's this emotional need to eat whatever the hell we can lay our hands on. And so I'd get home from an expedition like that and pretty much drain a fridge every day for a week. And, you know, we eat so much butter and fat on these expeditions. You know, we needed to get our calorific intake to 7,500 calories per person per day. That is a huge amount of butter and fat, essentially about 50% of our diet. But then when you get home, we're so attuned to the taste of fat that any small amount, like just a little swig of milk or something, it feels like I'm eating a pig. It tastes like I'm eating a pig, just a mouthful of fat. It was it took a while to get over that.
So in the years after this epic trek, you ended up working as a private guide for people wanting their own polar adventure. How did that lead to an opportunity to go to space?
Yeah. Oh, boy. So we were in Svalbard in 2023 guiding one of our novice expeditions, and I was skiing side by side with one of our clients, and he started talking about flying into space. Flying to the moon, flying to Mars, what it would be like, even flying to Venus. And it's like, wow, this guy has a pretty good concept of what's required to go up there, and certainly a passion and an affinity for space travel. I did too, because, you know, from watching the moon landing as a seven-year-old, this resonated throughout my whole life. And I often thought back to this moment when I was sitting with my school friends in year two or something. This moon landing, this resonated throughout my life, and it did with Chun too. So he could see that I was equally enamored about flying into space, and, you know, my next breath was singing Fly Me to the Moon. And little did I know that that would clinch me on a mission into space.
Well, what was he planning?
So he was planning, and he had put this to SpaceX, that he wanted to complete the first human mission over the North and South Poles. So this is called a 90-degree inclination orbit, where we go from our launch complex 39A, Cape Canaveral, where exactly the same launch pad that the Apollo astronauts launched from. We follow a launch corridor down the west coast of South America and go directly over the North Poles and stay on that polar orbital plane over the North and South Poles. He went to them and said, work out how to do this.
To SpaceX. Elon Musk's company.
Yeah, that's right. And they have this kind of unwritten motto of how do we arrive at yes. And it's one of the reasons they've been able to do the things that they've done, is because they find a way, like that same bulldog mentality I had all those years ago, of finding a way of doing this. And they did.
And how did you come to be a part of it?
So I was in Cape Town with my daughter. We were about to guide a group to Antarctica in December of 2023. And I received a text on my phone, and it was a text from Chun asking me whether I was interested in this mission and that he was looking for a polar explorer, and would I join him?
Was it an immediate yes from you?
It was an immediate yes in nanoseconds. I needed no time to think about that.
So you'd had enormous experience on the extremities of Earth, but no experience in space. What kind of training did you need to do?
Yes, so after, you know, signing up, our first port of call actually was at UCLA in Los Angeles to go through 2 days of intense medical screening. Then we went to Philadelphia, where we had some centrifuge training, where we'd sit on the end of this giant arm that would spin around inside this room and place us under G-forces that we'd never experienced before. And we needed to know that we were capable of surviving those. Then we started our training for real, and that was at SpaceX HQ in Los Angeles, where we spent, cumulatively you know, 4 months or so inside this training capsule where we were placed under pressure, stress, anxiety to perform simulations and see how we could unfold both individually and as a crew.
Mm. How many in the crew?
There were four of us in total. So Chun, who was the guy who invited me, who paid for the mission, a Bitcoin entrepreneur, a billionaire.
It'd require a bit of that, I would think, to arrange a trip into space.
Exactly right. And then the two others were Rabia Rogge, a German robotics engineer, PhD student, and Janneke Mikkelsen, who is an extreme environment filmmaker.
In the midst of all your training for this extraordinary trip into space, Eric, who did you reach out to?
Yeah, I have felt for a long time that something needed to resolve in my life. And Chun wanted me to put some historic posters up in Dragon while we're in orbit.
I love that this idea of sort of home decoration or interior decoration is crossing anyone's mind. Posters, just get the screws and the nuts and the oxygen working.
And I tell you, it's not an easy thing to have anything approved to take up into space. But he did request for these posters, so I selected 10 iconic expeditions. And one of those expeditions was that of Peter Hillary's father, Ed Hillary, who was on an expedition with Sir Vivian Fuchs, the British explorer. And their expedition would complete the very first crossing of Antarctica. They did that with vehicles. And Peter's dad, Ed, led the New Zealand component of that, going from the coast of Antarctica through to the South Pole, driving Massey Ferguson tractors. It was an incredible expedition. So I reached out to Peter and I said, look, you probably don't want to hear from me, but here's what I'm doing. And I would love for us to close a chapter here and, you know, the things we said and did back then during the South Pole expedition, that was kind of a different era of our lives. Let's move on. And he was so gracious about it. He said, I'd love to send you some photographs. And I put together this poster, which I did fly into space together with 9 others, and we pinned them up there. And we talked about those expeditions while we were up in space. And on our return, I bundled it up and I posted it across to Peter in New Zealand and gave him this memento of something that had flown into space and that I hope bonded the two of us again. I think it did.
So when the launch day came, Eric, did you and the crew feel ready?
Look, absolutely. By the time we were certified for flight, for want of a better word, we needed to demonstrate the same capabilities that, let's say, NASA astronauts need to arrive at before they fly on a similar mission to the International Space Station. The difference is that they have a career before arriving at the start point at SpaceX and then embarking on that training period that we did. So we kind of fast-tracked all of that and became astronauts and ready to fly and sat on top, 80 metres up on top of that, essentially an intercontinental ballistic missile, waiting for the countdown.
What was that moment like?
Oh, boy. You know what? I looked across at my crewmates. I was on the right-hand side looking out through the hatch, if it were open, and I looked at their faces, which you could just see through their visors and their helmets, and I didn't detect any fear, any anxiety, none of that. I could see smiles, wry smiles on their faces like I had. It's like, this feels so familiar. We had been in this situation, maybe not sitting up that high, but in the training capsule. We'd been in this situation many, many times, listening to that countdown and responding to emergencies that could erupt shortly after takeoff. So we were ready to go. It felt like a simulation. So with that countdown, 4, 3, 2, 1, takeoff, launch, we then couldn't hear anything because we had our comms in our ears, we had our helmets and visors down. But we could feel the rumble in the seat of our pants, and it was just this incredible shaking. And then of course, the G-forces kicked in, and we could feel that propulsion of those 9 Merlin engines. That's why it's called Falcon 9, kick in and then start to take us skyward. Within, you know, 1 minute and 10 seconds, we were higher than your average commercial jet. And this is what's called Max-Q, maximum dynamic pressure exerted on the rocket. If anything was going to go wrong, that was probably the point, but we kept on going upward.
And then you're in zero gravity.
Yeah. And then within minutes, really, we are above the Kármán line in zero gravity in space. But we continued upward past the International Space Station at 400 kilometres and arrived at our orbital height of 440 kilometres, where we're certainly in microgravity because I can see in the end of my seatbelt starting to float up by the side of my helmet. It's like, this is it. We're here. We're in space. This is microgravity. I can't wait to get the call from ground to unbuckle and doff our suits, take our suits off and enjoy being in space.
And as you're bobbing around up there, when did you first get to look out and see the Earth all the way below?
We had to wait again for ground to make the call to open the nose cone, and the nose cone is right at the pointy end of our vehicle. That hinges open and reveals this giant Perspex cupola, which is purpose designed to allow humans to observe the Earth and the cosmos from that vantage point. And we were over Antarctica at the time, so for me, a really profound moment that I... You know, this really brings emotions to the fore again, because this opportunity to be at this height with these incredible crew members and to observe this amazing rock that we live on and that there's no evidence yet anywhere else in the cosmos that life exists. It probably does, but we've not found it yet. That makes us incredibly special, and it makes that rock that we inhabit an incredibly special place. So to see it up there, it drew me to tears, as it's pretty much doing now.
What was it like to see those parts of our planet that you've always loved and spent so much time in, much more than most humans? What was it like to see them in particular from space? What did they look like?
Incredible, particularly the polar regions that I know so well, Svalbard, parts of Antarctica, that I could literally just look at and say, I've been there, I know that place. But something really special about Antarctica that really took me by surprise was the fact that we flew on the dark side of the equinox. So when we flew over Antarctica, there was this pall of blackness, the polar winter that had set over Antarctica. And to see that nothingness, there was nothing to see there but that blackness, that was so special for me.
When it was time to come back to Earth, Eric, what happens at re-entry?
Yeah, so we get the call from ground that, hey, the fun's over, the research is done, it's time for you to come back. So I, as a mission specialist, my task was to pack Dragon, which is the name of the spacecraft, Dragon Resilience, actually, to pack it so that the center of gravity would be precise for our return to Earth, because it was drilled into us. Screw that up, screw up the CG, and it could be catastrophic. So I spent a lot of time packing in all the locations where stuff needed to be. Then we donned our suits. We were cinched down in our restraints, tightened, and we started plummeting 500 kilometres an hour. You know, this is terminal velocity for a vehicle like that. Temperatures outside, 2,000 degrees centigrade, building up plasma on the outside. We could see that plasma building up on the two side windows. And by then, we're experiencing 4.6 G-forces. We couldn't lift our heads to see through those windows and see what was happening. But I managed to lift my arm, and I had this mirror mounted on my wrist where I could get a reflection down through the window. Sparks and plasma and the whole lot. And eventually, we had two drogue parachutes that deployed at about 5.5 kilometres. They slowed us down to 300 kilometres an hour. We continued to descend, and at 1.8, the four main parachutes deployed and slowed us down to 25 kilometres an hour, and we wafted down into the ocean.
How magnificent. Wow. What was it like for that hatch to open and smell your atmosphere again?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's kind of bizarre. We just wanted to stay up there. We weren't ready to come back. We had experienced something that so few people had. In fact, I was the 629th person to fly into space. So that's a pretty small handful of people. And it was weird, you know, being back in 1G, it was strange to walk across the deck of the ship. The next day, I remember being at a restaurant and I wanted to go and get a coffee. And I fully thought that I could just float across the restaurant and do that. And of course, gravity got in the way, physics got in the way and prevented me from doing so. But we were straight into finalising some of the research the moment that we stepped back on Earth.
It might be that that was the most extreme example of something you've had to do again and again, which is go from these experiences where you're pushing yourself to the limit and exploring to the full breadth of your adventurous bulldog spirit. What's it like, that transition back to regular life? How hard is that?
It's really interesting, and I've always been able to transition from life on expedition to life back in the real world, for want of a better term. And it's kind of what I did here as well. Despite the fact that I would have gone back in a heartbeat and still would, I just wanted to be up there. I wasn't ready for that transition. I really missed it. We all did. And we talked about it then and still do in a very loving way. We fell in love with our crew. We fell in love with the trainers. We fell in love with SpaceX. We fell in love with that incredible resilience Dragon capsule that protected us from the brutal vacuum of space and returned us to our loved ones. But I didn't want to come back.
So what's taking your focus now at this point?
Now I'm very much focused on continuing running my business, which is an organisation that that takes people on their own dreams to the Arctic and Antarctica, spending more time at home. We've just built a passive house and we've got a lot of landscaping to do there.
You must spend some nights, though, I can imagine, at your home looking up into the skies, and must feel very differently close to you than it does to the rest of us who've only ever been earthbound.
Yes, utterly. My family this year bought me a 6-inch Dobsonian telescope for my birthday. And it's not a hugely powerful thing, but it's kind of symbolic of this pivot from polar exploration into space somewhat. And I've been, you know, looking up at the heavens, dreaming about going back up there. It's unrealistic to think that that would ever happen again. But space is always there. My experience is always there. It's an experience that no one can take away from me. This life is an experience that no one can take away from me, and I've had the capability and the opportunity from the people that surround me and love me to do this. I'm forever grateful for them, as I am for my fellow humans on Earth to produce this incredible environment and planet that we live on. And if I never go up there again, I'm the happiest man on Earth.
Eric, it's been really remarkable to hear your stories. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sarah.
Eric Phillips was my guest today, and this conversation was produced by Jen Leake and recorded on the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.